Kins knew the details of what had happened to Tracy's sister, and how finding the body of another young woman buried in the woods could impact her.
Yeah, she said. Just feeling helpless, you know?
Not your fault.
Doesn't matter.
Nothing wrong with feeling bad, Kins said. I'll quit this job when I stop feeling bad. I'll know then that I'm dead inside.
He looked around the parking lot.
So, how'd we get here?
Tracy explained that Pryor had prepared search warrants for Mukherjee's phone carrier and what she'd learned from Andrei Vilkotsky about using Aditi's shared account to track Mukherjee's cell phone.
So if Nolasco asks, you can say Pryor found the body, Kins said.
Pryor did find the body, Tracy said. She nearly fell into the hole on top of it.
Is this a natural hole, or did somebody dig it? Kins asked.
I don't know. I'd guess that it's not natural, but it also doesn't look like it's been recently dug. It's deep. I'd say between 6 and 8 feet, maybe 4 feet in circumference. It may have been an old well partially filled in over the years and grown over.
That caused Kins to ask the obvious next question.
Could she have fallen in? An accident?
Could have, but if she did, it raises another question.
Why was she here?
Tracy nodded and pointed. She grew up in a home close by. She and her best friend lived in houses along that side of the park. It was practically their backyard. But she was estranged from her family and didn't have a reason to come back here.
If someone killed her, Tracy, it's likely they knew about the hole.
I agree.
The roommate?
Maybe. Maybe a family member. Someone who knows the park and the trails. Either that, or she came back to a place she knew and, distraught, killed herself.
In the hole? How?
Kins said. I don't know. I'm just throwing out possibilities. That's why I called Kelly Rosa.
Kins said. Any gun?
Not that I could see. It could be underneath her or somewhere in the brush. No sense speculating at this point. We'll know soon enough, too.
Jurisdiction is going to be a problem, Kins said.
Maybe. She could have been killed and her body dumped here.
How likely is that?
Tracy looked around the empty parking lot.
How'd she get here? Her car isn't here. It's parked on a side street close to her apartment. That increases the likelihood that someone killed her someplace else and dumped her body here, which would give us jurisdiction.
Is Pryor here?
I left her at the site to create a perimeter.
Kins looked over his shoulder at the formidable forest.
Better her than me.
He zipped closed his jacket.
Did Billy tell you about Foz?
Yeah, but not a lot. What the hell happened? Did they have the wrong apartment? Tracy asked.
I don't know. Billy gave me the Reader's Digest version also. They'll have all kinds of people out there, though, including FIT.
FIT stood for the Force Investigation Team. SPD had formed the team of 6 detectives as part of the federally mandated reforms created in response to the Justice Department's determination that Seattle police too often resorted to unnecessary force. A federal monitor overseeing those court-ordered reforms had recently applauded the department's response. This wasn't going to help.
Nights like this, Tracy wondered if maybe Kins was right. Maybe she should just stay home after her baby was born.
Foz stood in the hallway. Lopez's body lay beneath a medical examiner's white sheet, an army green bag close by to transport the body back to the ME's office after Stuart Funk finished his on-scene examination. An EMT kept asking Foz if he was all right, and Foz kept telling him he was fine, though he had a persistent ringing in his ears that sounded like static when a television went off the air, back before cable and 24-hour programming. He also had a headache. Though he maintained to everyone who asked that he was fine, nobody seemed to want to accept that answer. Or maybe the EMTs just didn't have much else to do. They weren't going to save Lopez. Andrea Gonzalez had seen to that. She'd put 3 bullets in Lopez's chest, damn near one on top of the other. Tenants living on the 5th floor had been told to stay inside their apartments, and none seemed too intent on disobeying that order. FIT investigators would eventually question every one of them about what they had seen and heard. In the interim, police officers flooded the hallway, the lobby, and the parking lot,
along with the throng of brass, which was expected in any officer-involved shooting, particularly with a federal monitor all over their collective ass. And that looked like it would be a significant problem. Foz had not found a gun beneath or anywhere near Eduardo Lopez's body. After clearing the neighbor's apartment, Foz had stepped into the hall to call Billy Williams. He'd given his sergeant a shortened version of the events. Billy had come to the apartment building to take command as the ranking officer. He'd also had the presence of mind to call Anderson Cooper and have them quickly secure a warrant to search Lopez's apartment. Williams's command lasted until Andrew Lobb, the violent crime section's on-duty lieutenant, arrived. Upon confirming a fatality from an officer-involved shooting, Lobb called FIT. FIT's sole function was to investigate whether the force used had been justified and to provide a report to SPD's Force Review Board. Before the Justice Department's mandate, violent crime detectives investigated officer-involved shootings. The new FIT unit, therefore, was a clear indication that the Justice Department did not trust them to be objective, which put the two units immediately at odds. FIT investigators had never discharged their weapons, and Foz and the other homicide investigators knew that until you had been through that experience, you couldn't possibly comprehend the games the mind could play on an officer. In the midst of such a stressful situation, the officer often saw things that were either not there or that were different from what the officer thought she'd perceived. They didn't understand how a detective's mind could fill in blanks while struggling to make sense of an often senseless situation. Foz didn't dislike the FIT investigators. Like most of the detectives in violent crimes, he considered them good people performing a shitty job while being highly scrutinized. But that didn't mean he trusted them either. At present, Lobb, Williams, and Johnny Nolasco stood inside Lopez's crowded apartment while FIT investigators questioned Andrea Gonzalez. The FIT lieutenant had already confiscated Gonzalez's weapon and performed a round count. He would also determine if both the firearm and the ammunition were department approved. That was the least of Gonzalez's troubles. Shooting an unarmed man would be the real shitstorm. And that was the reason for the warrant to search Lopez's apartment. Now, more than ever, they needed to find a .38 and pray that gun barrel matched the bullet that killed Monique Rogers. Killing an unarmed guilty man was a problem. Killing an unarmed innocent man was much worse. Foz and Gonzalez would both be required to give tape-recorded statements and to complete written reports before they could go home. They would then be put on administrative leave and required to meet with a mental health professional before being considered for reinstatement to active duty. For some officers, that process could take more than a year. Then, when the officer did return, they would learn that they'd been assigned to a different unit, creating a stigma of wrongdoing, despite the exoneration. Foz had called Vera, knowing the story would be broadcast on the evening news. He told her he was fine, but had another long night ahead of him, and she should not wait up. When he asked how she was doing, she said, "Fine." She did not elaborate. Foz heard the elevator ping and looked down the hallway to see what fool had stepped aboard and the expression on that person's face when they got off. Dell walked off gingerly, one hand clasped over his nose and mouth. He had a wide-eyed look of horror that made Foz laugh, despite the circumstances. To shorten the distance and not be in view of the brass talking to Gonzalez inside the apartment, Foz met him halfway down the hall.
"Good Lord and Savior, Foz, what the hell is that smell? I thought the body was in the elevator."
Foz smiled.
"I would have warned you if I'd known you were coming."
"No, you wouldn't have," Dell said.
"No, I probably wouldn't have," Foz agreed.
The levity between two men who'd been through a lot during the past 20 years was a welcome release of nervous tension.
"Are you okay?"
Dell asked.
"I think I'm doing better than you."
Foz pointed at Dell's shoes, which didn't match. One loafer was a darker shade of brown.
"You get dressed in the dark?"
"I can hardly bend over. At least they're both brown," Dell said. "Seriously, are you okay?"
Foz nodded.
"Yeah, I'm fine. I got a ringing in my ears and a massive headache. But I think that's more from anticipating the amount of paperwork, interviews, and bullshit they're going to throw my way."
"What happened? Billy wouldn't tell me anything."
Foz looked down the hall to be sure no one was approaching.
I really don't know, he pointed. I was standing right there, facing the door to Lopez's apartment. Gonzalez was on the other side. Next thing I know, her eyes get as wide as saucers, and she's shoving me into that wall. She fired 3 times. Bam, bam, bam.
Wait, so where was Lopez?
The apartment next door.
What was he doing there?
Don't know.
Was he armed?
Foz shook his head.
Oh, shit. Are you sure it's Lopez?
Del asked, looking at the covered body.
Yeah, I'm sure. This isn't going to play well with the Justice Department. We'd better hope ballistics can match a gun with the bullet that killed Monique Rogers.
It will help, but it won't solve the problem, not for Gonzalez. What did Gonzalez say? Why'd she shoot?
She said she saw something silver in Lopez's hand and thought he was taking aim at the back of my head. Turns out, it was a cell phone.
Del rubbed a hand over the stubble on his chin.
Well, that's something, I guess.
I guess, Foz said. But not having Lopez creates a bigger problem, even if they find a gun and match it to the shooting.
It isn't the same as a confession, Del said.
And it doesn't tell us why he did it, Foz said. Or if he was acting on orders. Little Jimmy is the guy we want.
Foz looked down the hall as Larry Pinnacle, an FIT investigator, exited the apartment and approached. Pinnacle greeted Del, then spoke to Foz.
We're ready to head back to Park 95. We're going to need to get a statement before you go off duty.
Foz nodded. Understood.
As Pinnacle departed, Del said,
That's one guy I never cared for.
He's all right, Foz said.
How's Vera?
Weepy. It's been tough on her. Late nights like this aren't helping.
You want me to stop by, tell her what's happening?
I called. She's okay.
Hey, Foz, I want you to know that I'm sorry I wasn't here.
I know you are. Shit happens. Don't worry about it.
Foz looked down the hall toward the sound of voices that were increasing in volume. The group had moved from inside the apartment to the hallway. Gonzalez turned her head and looked to where Foz and Del stood, just a passing glance before she returned her attention to her interrogators.
Rough way to start out in a new department, Foz said.
She might be going home before she ever got started, Del said.
27. Tracy knew logistics would be the CSI investigator's biggest hurdle. It wasn't like they could just plug in a light to an electrical circuit in one of the trees. CSI had a van that provided power, but there was no way to get the van to the gravesite, which was how Tracy now thought of the hole in the ground. CSI's only option was to haul generators to the site, a difficult and time-consuming process. Once accomplished, the investigators expanded the perimeter Pryor had marked with yellow crime scene tape. Anyone who breached this designated area would be required to sign a login sheet. Next, they directed a tent over the grave and attached lights to the tent's interior framework, enough light to illuminate the site like an archaeological dig for some lost treasure. Tracy wished it were so. CSI did all of this while trying not to disturb the trails leading to the hole any more than Tracy and Pryor already had. Kaylee Wright arrived and worked with the CSI investigators to reestablish Katie Pryor's walking path to the gravesite, designated with red tape. Anyone who crossed that tape would have to complete a statement, which was a way to keep the brass from venturing too close to the crime scene. Not that the brass was going to be a problem this night, not with the majority of them flocking to the officer-involved shooting in South Park. Once she'd reestablished the walking path, Wright used a powerful beam of light to examine the area surrounding the grave, the trails leading to it, and the main walking paths into and out of the park. She was trying to detect patterns, footprints leading to and from the hole, veering off course suddenly, or signs of an altercation, like trampled plants and disturbed soil. CSI would also take a healthy number of photographs and, where possible, cast any shoe prints found. After Katie Pryor had provided elimination prints of the soles of her work boots, Tracy sent her home. Pryor had protested, but with Kins present and the missing persons having now become a possible homicide, Pryor was no longer needed, though that was not why Tracy sent her home. She sent Pryor home to be with her family.
Kelly Rosa arrived and quickly climbed down a ladder with a CSI photographer to document the gravesite and the body's relationship to it. Rosa's first order of business, however, was to confirm a death and to obtain positive identification. Next, she sketched the position of the body relative to the hole. After documenting the site in photographs, Rosa turned her analysis to determining whether Kavita Mukherjee was the victim of a homicide, an unfortunate accident, or had taken her own life. As this work went on, and although a significant number of police and forensic personnel were present, the site remained respectfully quiet, as if a pall of sadness had descended over the forest, disturbed only by the hum of the generators and occasional hushed voices. Tracy heard footsteps, and she and Kins backed away from the hole and met Kaylee Wright on the designated path. A senior crime analyst, Wright was about the same age and height as Tracy, but with dark hair and a darker complexion. She carried a pencil and a stack of blue index cards on which she documented the size and shape of each shoe print found. Her face remained a practiced mask, revealing little about her findings. She kept her voice soft. "I can't say anything definitive yet." "But you're picking up something," Tracy said, knowing Wright well enough to make the inference. Wright frowned. "Maybe. I've been all over the two main trails." She checked notes she'd taken. "The Coyote Trail and the Trillium Trail." She used a pencil on a trail map to crudely identify the location of the two trails and the footpath leading from them to the hole in the ground. "Never thought I'd say this in Seattle, but the prolonged week of warm weather and lack of rain made it tough to find any definitive shoe prints. Usually there are periods in the day, early morning and late evening, in which there is enough moisture in the air that the sole of the shoe will leave an impression. I'm just not finding anything much. I can say that a lot of people have been through here, some on horseback." "What about the victim? Have you found her shoe prints anywhere near the hole?" Tracy asked. Wright shook her head. "No, and it's a fairly specific sole pattern, a flat, casual walking shoe. If it was around here, I'd recognize it." "Not exactly the kind of shoe a person wears to walk through a heavily wooded park," Kin said. "No, it's not." Wright shuffled through her deck of blue cards and showed them the image of the shoe she had drawn. "It's made by American Rag. See the distinct sole pattern?" Tracy did. Four more or less square treads from the top of the toe to the ball of the foot. 8 total squares. "And you're not finding that pattern anywhere along the footpath leading to the hole or around it?" she asked, hoping it meant the body had been moved. Wright shook her head. "Not on the footpath and not around the hole. However, I did find the print on both the Trillium and on the Coyote Trail, indicating she was headed in this direction." "So we know that she walked into the park," Kin said. "At least for part of the way," Wright said. "What do you mean?" Tracy asked. "She was running for another part." "She was being chased?" Tracy asked. Wright shook her head. "She started out walking, but at some point, based on her elongated stride, she started to run. Then she stopped. I found her footprints on the trail facing in all different directions. I didn't find any other footprints to indicate she was running from someone." "But she stopped and was, what, turning in a circle?" "It appears so." "She could have gotten lost," Kin said. "She could have been trying to reorient herself." Tracy shook her head. "Aditi said they knew this park well. She could have thought she heard something," Tracy said. "That would cause her to run in the first place. She might have heard something and took off running, then stopped, either to catch her breath or to look around for anyone following her." "But you're not finding any footprints of someone giving chase?" Kin said. "No, and there is just the one set of footprints when she stops and turns." "But no footprints around the perimeter of the hole?" Tracy asked again for clarification. "Not hers." "You would expect to find her print, wouldn't you?" Tracy prompted. "I would if she walked or ran over there. Even if she fell into the hole, I'd expect to find a shoe print or a partial shoe print somewhere around the perimeter. For example, I found Katie Pryor's prints where she stepped and lost her footing, and I found your shoe print. I also found a flat shoe print, but only a partial. I'm not sure it's going to be of much help." "So the logical deduction from the lack of her shoe print near the hole is that while she may have walked into the park and at some point started running, for whatever reason, she didn't walk or run to the hole, Kin said.
No evidence to indicate she did, Wright said.
So we can rule out that she fell into the hole while running, Tracy said.
No evidence she did, Wright said.
On its own, it's not much. But if Kelly determines the victim didn't die from falling into that hole, the lack of any shoe prints would certainly support the argument that she was killed someplace else in the park and her body dumped in the hole.
Kins glanced at Tracy. She knew he was thinking that if Wright was accurate, the killer had to have known the hole existed and hadn't just blindly stumbled upon it while looking to discard a body. It also meant they might not get the chance to figure out what had happened. Bellevue would rightfully take jurisdiction.
Wright turned again, this time to the illuminated tent.
I looked closely at the branches covering the hole. I didn't see where any of them had snapped or been broken, other than those Pryor broke when she fell through. I'm also not finding any hair or clothing fibers, and Kelly said an initial review of the decedent's clothing did not reveal any rips or snags. I'd like to look more closely, under magnification, and I'd also like to look at the branches under natural light before I reach any conclusions.
You're saying that if she did fall into the hole, you'd expect to find some evidence of it, Kin said.
Wright nodded.
Right now, I'm just not finding any.
So Pryor's falling was fortuitous in terms of the evidence you'd expect to find, Kin said.
It's certainly evidence that a healthy individual would grab whatever was around them to try to keep from dropping into the hole, and we'd find snapped branches and disturbed leaves.
Whereas if somebody dumped the body, they could have been careful to move the branches to ensure it didn't look disturbed, Tracy said.
That's at least a working hypothesis, Wright said.
Then they had to have known the hole was there, Kins reiterated, which would imply they had familiarity with the park.
Any indication anyone came back to try and fill in the hole?
No tool marks to indicate that was the case, Wright said.
Tracy nodded to the stack of cards in Wright's hand.
Anything else of interest?
Wright shook her head.
Not at present, though again, I'd like to have another look in daylight. The trails have been well used and the darkness doesn't help. As I said, I found disturbed prints of people walking and jogging and horse hooves, but nothing definitive.
No prints to indicate someone or some persons carried a body here? Tracy asked.
Not yet.
So what we have is what we don't have, Tracy said. We don't have broken branches or foliage to indicate the victim fell into the hole. We don't have snagged hair or clothing fibers, and we don't have the victim's shoe prints near the hole.
All true, Wright said.
But we do have the victim's prints on the designated trails to indicate she voluntarily walked into the park and at some point started running in this direction.
Correct, Wright said.
Maybe she was meeting someone who knew the park as well as she knew it, Kins said.
Tracy thought of Aditi.
I'll come back out tomorrow morning in daylight and recheck everything, Wright said.
How long will we have the site?
For as long as we need. At least Tracy hoped that was the case. She looked at the tent, and in the bright lights, she saw a seasoned-looking man in a navy blue Bellevue police uniform talking to one of the CSI detectives. The detective looked around and spotted Tracy and Kins. He pointed in their direction. 28. Foz sat at a conference room table in the Park 95 building, his hands cradling a cup of lukewarm black coffee. He'd have opted for an espresso or caffeine IV. He was that tired.
Maybe, he thought, he was just getting too old for this crap.
Or maybe Vera's illness was taking more out of him than he'd admit. He had enough years to retire on a full pension, like Arroyo. But then what would he do? He and Vera had talked of traveling, seeing those places they hadn't been able to afford and never had the time to visit. He wanted to go back to Italy, where they'd honeymooned, and he'd promised Vera they'd get to Paris and to Barcelona. But now those trips were on hold. He stretched the fatigue from his legs and cracked his neck, which was where he carried most of his stress. Two Advil had not yet dented the headache that had developed, nor had time silenced the persistent ringing in his ears. His arms and legs felt heavy,
and he knew from experience that fatigue was to be expected after the body and the mind had undergone a stressful event. He wanted nothing more than for this night to be over, to go home and get much-needed rest. But he had a feeling the night was just getting started.
"You doing okay, Foz?"
Larry Pinnacle asked the question as he walked into the conference room and shut the door. A former burglary detective, Pinnacle had become one of the six FIT investigators when that team formed in 2014. Foz had a brief working relationship with Pinnacle. They'd always been cordial, but that was the extent of their involvement. He didn't really care. He wasn't looking to make a new friend or hang out with the guy. He just wanted to give his statement and get home. Foz sat up.
"Just tired, you know. Let's get this done."
"We'll try to make this as quick as possible," Pinnacle said.
Foz doubted it.
"You've been read your Garrity rights and signed the form?" Pinnacle asked.
Garrity rights protected public employees from being compelled to incriminate themselves during investigatory interviews conducted by their employers, a protection that stemmed from the 5th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, which protected a person from being a witness against himself. Foz slid the sheet of paper he'd signed across the table. Pinnacle considered it briefly and set it aside. He slowly lowered his body into a chair. He reminded Foz of a walrus with a drooping mustache that covered his upper lip and a pear-shaped body and large head.
"Good, okay. Any questions before we get started?"
Foz shook his head and Pinnacle adjusted a tape recorder on the table.
"We're going to record this, okay?"
He hit record without waiting for an answer and edged the recorder halfway between the two of them. Foz took out his phone and said,
"I'm going to record it too."
He hit the record button and slid his phone next to the recorder. Pinnacle looked at the phone but didn't otherwise respond. Then he identified himself, his position, badge number, and his intent to interview Detective Vittorio Fazio in the officer-involved shooting death of Eduardo Felix Lopez. When he'd dispensed with the preliminaries, Pinnacle read from a second sheet of paper. Though Foz had never been through the process, he understood from others that FIT followed a written script and that their investigators had been trained to avoid showing emotion. It had earned them the nickname RoboCops.
"Detective Fazio, are you aware that I will be asking you questions regarding that shooting?"
"Yes," Foz said.
Pinnacle sat back, making eye contact.
"Okay. Can you first explain to me, what was your purpose at the apartment building in South Park?"
"We had a last known address for Eduardo Lopez."
"Who is?"
"Oh, sorry."
Foz shook his head to clear the cobwebs and sipped his coffee.
"A suspect in the shooting of Monique Rogers."
"Thank you. Continue."
"The apartment unit was 511. Our purpose was to conduct a non-custodial interview of Mr. Lopez."
"And why wasn't SWAT involved?"
"No need. It was a non-custodial interview."
"Who made that decision?"
"I did," Foz said.
"Did you believe Mr. Lopez to be armed?"
"Unknown."
"So possibly?"
Pinnacle asked.
"Everyone is possibly armed, especially in this day and age," Foz said. "Did I think he was armed and a threat?" "No."
"You suspected he was your shooter in the Rogers homicide?"
Foz shrugged. He knew the purpose of the question and wasn't about to fall into the trap of saying yes, then have Pinnacle question why, in that case, he hadn't assumed Lopez would still be armed.
"We didn't know he was the shooter. We knew his handprint was on a car parked in the vicinity of the shooting. He could have just been a guy fleeing the shooting who stuck his hand on the hood of a parked car, who might have relevant information. That's what we were hoping to determine."
"Did you or your partner want SWAT to accompany you in issuing the search warrant?"
"As I said, there was no need for SWAT or a search warrant. As for what Andrea Gonzalez thought or wanted, you'd have to ask her that question. I'm not going to speculate."
"Did she tell you she wanted SWAT present?"
Foz was trying to determine where Pinnacle was going with his questions, which didn't sound scripted, as he'd been told.
"She mentioned in the car that sometimes she felt better when SWAT was involved."
"You remember her saying that?"
"Words to that effect, yes."
"What exactly do you remember her saying?"
Foz blew out a breath. It seemed as though an eternity had passed since he and Gonzalez had been in the car driving to the building.
"She said something like she felt more secure having someone with an AR-15 ready to put a round up somebody's ass."
"But you didn't think SWAT should be present?" In this instance, no. As I said, it was a non-custodial interview. We had no evidence Lopez was armed or that he was Rogers' shooter, and there was no indication he knew we were coming and would consider us a threat. So, non-custodial interview. What evidence did you have besides the video of Lopez touching the parked car and leaving his print? Foz sipped his coffee and set the cup down, picking at the rim with his fingernail. That was it. Would it have been a reasonable assumption that Lopez would be armed, given that you suspected him to be the shooter of Monique Rogers? How many times do I have to say this? I'm sure there are videos out there of a lot of guys who were in that area. Should we consider each of them to be armed and a threat? We just wanted to talk to the guy, find out what he was doing over there, if he saw anything, determine if he started acting squirrely, and take it from there. But you didn't ask that question of your chain of command, correct? What question? If we should get SWAT involved? No, I didn't ask them that. Foz could see the hamster wheel spinning in Pinnacle's head, and he suddenly realized he'd made a mistake. Damned if you do, and damned if you don't. If they were proceeding under the assumption that Lopez was unarmed, then why had Gonzalez been so quick to shoot? She'd have to answer that question on her own. Pinnacle quickly pressed on. So, you went to the apartment for a non-custodial interview. And to ask if we could search his apartment. Were you looking for anything in particular? Foz paused. Then he said, a gun and a hoodie. A hoodie being what, exactly? A hooded sweatshirt. In the video, Lopez had a hood pulled over his head. What did you deduce from that? Possibly that he was trying to conceal his identity. And what type of gun were you searching for? If we had the chance, we were looking for a revolver, a .38. We didn't find any shell casings at the site of Monique Rogers' shooting, so we were proceeding under the assumption that her shooter used a revolver. The slug that killed her was a .38. And what happened when you arrived at the apartment? Foz took a moment. With fatigue, the ringing in his ears had become more persistent. He tugged at an earlobe, like a swimmer trying to dislodge water. I was standing on the north side of the doorframe. Detective Gonzalez was standing on the south side. Detective Gonzalez is not your regular partner, is she? No. My regular partner, Del Castigliano, hurt his back and took a personal day. You'd never worked with Detective Gonzalez before? No. She'd just started Monday. Did you have any concerns bringing a detective with unknown experience to execute a dynamic search warrant? I didn't say it was a dynamic search warrant, Foz said. A dynamic warrant was a label given to a search warrant if the person to be confronted was suspected of being armed and dangerous. I said it was a non-custodial interview. Did I have any concerns bringing Gonzalez along? No. I understood that Gonzalez had been a detective in Los Angeles and had significant experience. And where did you gain that understanding? That's what she told me. You didn't attempt to verify the information? Foz chuckled. Verify how, Larry? Somebody tells me they have experience. I don't call them a liar. Pinnacle remained all business. So you didn't attempt to verify the information? Foz didn't immediately answer. He knew Pinnacle was only doing his job. But what was it about bureaucratic posts that made detectives forget their own experiences and become officious assholes? I assumed, since she'd been hired to the violent crimes section, that she'd been properly vetted during the interview process. But that's above my pay grade. Maybe that's a question better asked of Lieutenant Laub or Captain Alasco. You were describing what happened when you arrived at the apartment? Foz paused to recall where he'd left off. He was starting to feel like this was an interrogation designed not to get his recollection, but to trip him up, get him talking, change subjects, create confusion, anything so he couldn't pick up on a rehearsed thread. Foz had used similar tactics conducting his own interviews, only this wasn't a rehearsed thread, and Foz wasn't a suspect. Or was he? Shit, he was tired, and not just from the evening. He was emotionally tired from the past few days since Vera's diagnosis, and he wasn't getting any younger. He took a moment, sipped his coffee. The ringing in his ear persisted, and he again tugged on his earlobe. Are you all right to continue? Pinnacle said. Yeah, I'm fine, Foz said.
After another moment, he said, I was on the north side of the doorframe, and Detective Gonzalez was on the south side. This was apartment 511. She was about to knock on the door to the apartment when I heard a voice that sounded like it was coming from inside the apartment, and I put my hand up to stop her.
Had you or Detective Gonzalez removed your firearms from their holsters at this point?
Not at that point. Foz was trying to recall when he had removed his gun.
You're sure?
Yeah.
Did Detective Gonzalez identify you both as Seattle police officers?
She never got the chance.
As I said, I heard someone.
What did they say?
I don't know. It sounded like the person was speaking Spanish.
Was the person speaking Spanish?
Gonzalez thought so. She mouthed the word Spanish to me, and she speaks the language.
From where did you hear the voice?
Inside the apartment, I thought. But I wasn't certain, so I was asking Gonzalez, and that's...
You didn't know?
I wasn't sure. I thought it was from inside Lopez's apartment.
So did Gonzalez.
But it could have been in the apartment next door.
Could you hear what was being said?
I told you I could hear it. I couldn't understand it.
Pinnacle made a note on his pad of paper.
Go on.
Had there even been a question?
Foz didn't think so, but he was anxious to get the interview over with.
Detective Gonzalez went to knock, and suddenly I hear something, a door opening behind me, and I see her eyes go wide like there's a big surprise behind me.
She was looking at you or the door to the apartment she was knocking on?
She was looking at me, not at me, but just over my left shoulder.
Foz made a vague gesture with his hands.
And I see her eyes go wide, big as two saucers. Next thing I know, she's taking a step toward me and raising her arm, holding her gun over my shoulder.
Did you hear anything before you saw her looking over your left shoulder?
Like I said, I heard the voice speak in Spanish, and I heard a door opening behind me.
Did you turn around to find out?
I don't specifically recall that. I was looking at Gonzalez, and my focus was on the door she was about to knock on.
What happened next?
She shoved me, and I stumbled backward against the other side of the hall.
She shoved you off balance?
Foz detected a hint of disbelief in the question. He was 6'4" and 270 pounds. Gonzalez was 5'6" and maybe 130 pounds.
Yeah, she did. And she raised her arm and yelled, gun.
She yelled, gun?
As she was raising her weapon, she yelled, gun, and gets off three quick shots one after the other.
She pushed you backward before or after she yelled gun?
It was all about the same time. She yells gun as she's raising her right arm and shoves me with her left arm.
Foz used his arms to demonstrate.
And you said that she yelled gun?
That's right.
You didn't yell gun?
Foz paused, staring Pinnacle in the eyes.
What? You didn't yell gun?
I told you I had my back to the door. Why would I yell gun?
I'm just trying to get the story straight.
No, you're not. You're provoking me. Seeing if I say something that doesn't match with what I already said and you're pissing me off.
Pinnacle didn't respond to the comment. He said, You were facing the door you were knocking on, correct?
No, Foz said, unable to hide the irritation in his voice and using his hands to explain where he was standing in relation to the door.
I was standing at an angle, facing the window at the end of the hall, and focused on the door to Lopez's apartment, the door Gonzalez was about to knock on.
You never saw the suspect come out of the door?
How could I? The door was behind me,
Foz said, becoming angry.
I'm just asking. And I told you. Let's move on.
Pinnacle seemed to give this some thought. Then he said,
Is there any doubt in your mind that it was Detective Gonzalez who yelled gun?
Do I have any doubt?
Yes.
Foz had interviewed enough suspects to detect tells. Pinnacle lowered his gaze and sat back, pen in hand. He thought Foz was lying.
No, I have no doubt, Foz said. And you have no doubt that she looked over your shoulder, saw the suspect, and advanced, knocking you out of the way?
No, I don't.
You said she was knocking on the door?
I said she was preparing to knock on the door.
So she was facing the door, preparing to knock on it?
Right.
You didn't draw her attention to the suspect?
Draw her attention how?
You didn't yell gun.
Foz chuckled.
What is this shit, Larry?
Pinnacle didn't answer.
Did she say I yelled gun?
So you didn't yell gun.
I told you, Larry.
Did you yell gun?
I told you I didn't.
And you didn't otherwise draw Detective Gonzalez's attention from the door to the suspect coming out of the apartment.
I'm done with this shit.
Foz pushed back his chair and stood.
I'll tell you when we're done, Detective.
No, you won't. I'm done, or else I want a union representative before any further questioning. Pinnacle had also stood. He held his pen in one hand but raised both palms.
All right, all right. Let's just move on, okay?
We'll move on.
What is this shit? Did she say I yelled gun?
Let's move on. Tell me what you recall happening after she pushed you into the hall wall.
Foz adjusted his chair and sat, taking a moment to sip his coffee, which was no longer warm. When composed, he said,
My ears were ringing from having her Glock go off by my left ear. The next thing I heard was Gonzalez asking me if I was all right.
Why? What had happened?
Foz stared at Pinnacle.
I just told you. She fired three shots close to my ear. I couldn't hear anything she was saying.
Was she saying something?
I couldn't hear.
But you heard her ask if you were okay.
Eventually, yeah.
How much time passed before you could hear her?
I don't know.
Seconds? Minutes?
No, it was seconds.
And then what?
And then she went into the apartment Lopez had come out of. There was a woman inside, sitting on the floor, pressed against the wall. She was shielding a small child. Both were screaming.
What was the woman screaming?
I don't know. I mean, you know, she was crying.
You couldn't hear her because of the ringing in your ears?
Gonzalez asked her something in Spanish, and she responded in Spanish.
What do you weigh?
Foz paused again.
Is that relevant?
Pinnacle stared at him.
I don't know.
I'm about 270 pounds.
Pinnacle wrote the number on his pad of paper. Then he sat back.
When Gonzalez went into the apartment, what did you do?
I looked at the suspect to ensure he was dead, and I looked for a gun.
Was he dead?
Very.
Did you find a gun?
I didn't see one. I saw a phone near his right hand. I thought maybe he'd fallen on the gun.
Did you look beneath him?
Not then.
What did you do?
I cuffed Lopez, then went into the apartment with Gonzalez and helped clear the rooms.
What was Gonzalez doing?
Like I said, there was a woman and a child in the apartment huddled in the corner. They were crying, hysterical. Gonzalez was speaking to them in Spanish.
Could you understand her?
No, but I'm pretty sure she was asking the name of the man in the hallway.
And what did the woman tell Detective Gonzalez?
She said it was Eduardo Lopez.
Detective Fazio, did you ever find a gun?
I did not.
What about inside the apartment? Did you find a gun inside that apartment?
The apartment that the woman and child were in?
No.
We didn't have a search warrant for that apartment, so we only conducted a visual search of the vicinity for our safety.
And you didn't go into the suspect's apartment?
No. We waited for CSI.
The death of Monique Rogers. That's your only open case, isn't it?
That's right.
You and Detective Castigliano have solved every homicide in your careers. Is that also correct?
That's correct.
And Lopez was your only lead in the Rogers case. Am I right about that also?
To this point, yes.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Then I'll shut off the tape.
Pinnacle did so. Then he looked across the table.
Thank you, Detective. We're done here.
Foz gathered his phone. He wanted to believe Pinnacle, but he knew from experience that this wasn't the end of the matter. Not by a long shot. 29.
Tracy and Kinsey's conversation with Bellevue Police Department Captain Ray Giacomoto was professional and direct. Giacomoto wanted to know what Tracy and Kins were doing on this side of the lake, and why they hadn't called his department. The victim was a Seattle resident, and the missing persons report was filed with Seattle PD, Tracy said. We didn't come here thinking we'd stumble on a body. We were tracking her cell phone. When we found the victim, I thought it best to get the site processed before any further time elapsed, and possible evidence disappeared.
Giacomoto grinned.
We're fully equipped to process a crime scene, Detective. I think you know that.
Absolutely, Tracy said.
So what was the rush? Did you know the victim? Only what I've learned through interviews of her roommate and her family. We've been investigating the victim's disappearance for a few days now.
The body wasn't going anywhere fast, Giacomoto said again.
No, it wasn't.
Which would put it in Bellevue jurisdiction.
Maybe, but I had no way of knowing. And we still don't know definitively that the victim was killed here. There are no footprints around the hole, so the initial opinion of the tracker is she was killed elsewhere and the body dumped here. Tracy didn't say that the initial opinion was Kavita Mukherjee was killed elsewhere in the park.
It has also been a long time since we've had any rain, Tracy said, and the newsmen were forecasting that thunderstorm. So, as I said, I thought it best to get the site processed before any footprints or other possible evidence might have washed away.
Giacomoto didn't look fully convinced, but for the moment he seemed content to let her do her job.
We're going to want copies of all the reports, he said.
Not a problem, Tracy said.
As for jurisdiction, I suspect that's a decision higher up both our chains of command. Until then, I'm happy to sit back and let you run this show.
They turned to the sound of someone approaching. Kelly Rosa had climbed out of the hole. She looked very much like an archaeologist on a dig, with dirt clinging to the cuffs of her blue jeans just above sturdy boots, and along the brim of a mariner's baseball cap. Rosa flipped off her headlamp so she didn't blind them, and pulled down a mask that had been covering her nose and mouth. She then removed latex gloves and wiped dirt from the tail of her shirt. Her gait was awkward from rubber knee pads.
That's a new look for you, Kin said, pointing to the pads.
Saw them at Costco, she said. They're for tile workers. The knees aren't as young as they used to be.
I thought you were trying out to be a catcher, Kin said.
Yeah, well, the Mariners could use somebody who can actually hit, she said. Then after a pause, she said, I can tell you it wasn't a robbery, or if it was, it was perpetrated by the stupidest robbers on the planet. Barely 5 feet tall, Rosa had a 7-foot personality. She has $12 in her pocket, along with a Washington State driver's license and a credit card, a gold chain around her neck, and a gold bracelet on her wrist.
So, no robbery, and the killer wasn't trying to conceal her identity, Kin said. Except for the fact that the killer dumped her in a hole in the ground covered by brush, Giacomoto said. Nobody likes a show-off, Kin said.
You said dumped, so this wasn't an accident? Tracy said.
No, Rosa said. I don't believe it was. What do you believe it was? Giacomoto asked.
Rosa raised an arm and imitated blows to the skull as she said, She died from blunt force trauma. Several blows to the side of her head. I'd say 2, maybe 3. We won't know the number without some close-up photography of the injury. She was struck on the right side by something irregular-shaped, a rock, most likely. I'd have some of these uniforms searching the park for a rock with blood on it.
Could be like finding a needle in a haystack, Kin said. A 500-acre haystack.
Or the killer could have just dropped it and it's still around here, Rosa said.
You're certain the killer used a rock? Giacomoto said.
Not until we do some work under the microscope, but I'd say it's a strong probability.
So she was killed here in the park? Giacomoto asked.
Not for me to say, Rosa said, and Tracy sensed the medical examiner was cutting her some slack. I can say she wasn't killed in or near the hole, but as to where, she shrugged.
I'll get some of my uniforms to do a search of the park. Giacomoto said to Tracy. Have you had someone go over the trails yet?
Tracy nodded. It's being done, but I always appreciate another set of eyes. Giacomoto handed Rosa a card.
I'd like a copy of your report when it's ready, he said before departing.
Rosa's statement made Kaylee Wright's hypothesis that Mukherjee had been carried to the hole and dumped one step closer to a theory.
What else? Tracy said.
There's little blood in the hole. If she fell and hit her head, she would have bled out, and I'd expect a lot more.
Liver mortis is consistent with the position of the body in the hole, Rosa said.
But that's probably because she was killed and quickly moved. Rosa was referencing the purplish discoloration that, in death, settled in areas of the body closest to the ground.
When was she last seen alive?
Monday evening, Tracy said. Early, around 6 o'clock. Rosa turned back toward the hole, talking as if to herself. No rigor mortis, so she's been dead at least 12 hours, but probably longer than that.
She has abdominal discoloration and some bloating, indicating at least 36 to 48 hours, as well as the preliminary indications of marbling of the skin.
So Monday night is a possibility, Tracy said.
Definitely a possibility, but we'll get it figured out and narrowed.
For somebody to hit her multiple times in the head with a rock, Kin said.
Yeah, I know where you're going, Rosa said. These were significant blows, too.
Somebody angry, Kin said.
Rosa shrugged. That's for you guys to prove, but I can say the force of the blows are consistent with someone who meant to cause damage. We're getting ready to move the body. Then the site is all yours.
Any indication of sexual assault? Tracy asked, mentally going through her checklist and ticking off boxes.
Won't know for certain until we get her to the lab. But there's no evidence of a struggle. No torn or ripped articles of clothing, no cuts or scratches. Fingernails look clean. But again, we'll get that figured out.
Wonder if you can take a little while putting together your report, Tracy said.
I'm pretty busy, Rosa said, smiling. And I can be called away at a moment's notice.
She winked and walked back to the grave.
As Rosa departed, Tracy said to Kins, Not a robbery, and probably not a rape. Significant blows to the head.
You said she had no boyfriend?
Not that we know of, but she was on a date.
Tracy again turned to the sound of people approaching. This time a uniformed officer holding a clipboard led a woman in brown pants with multiple pockets, boots, and a black heavy-duty Carhartt jacket.
Detectives, the officer said. This is Margot Page. She's the park ranger in charge of this park.
Tracy extended a hand and introduced herself and Kins.
How long have you worked this park? She asked.
Page's gaze kept shifting past Tracy to the tent over the hall. She had a soft voice, though deeper than Tracy expected.
About 3 years now.
So you're familiar with it?
As much as one can be, yes.
Come with me. She led Paige down the path CSI had designated and stopped at the crime scene tape tied to the tent poles.
Are you familiar with that hole?
Paige looked confused.
Familiar as in what?
Did you know it existed? Tracy asked.
It wasn't dug? Paige asked.
Not recently, Tracy said. Paige shook her head.
No, I didn't know anything about it. If I had, I would have had it filled in.
How prevalent are holes like this in the park? Tracy asked. Paige looked to be giving the question some thought.
You have to remember this park is just about 500 acres, detective, with more than 28 miles of trails and houses bordering the perimeter. But to my knowledge, I'd say that it is not prevalent. In fact, I'm not aware of any others.
None? Kins said.
Not that I'm aware of.
Any idea what it is, how it got here? Tracy asked.
Paige nodded. Given its relative proximity to the houses that butt up against the park, she said, pointing to lights on the back of the homes. I'd guess it's an old well, probably bootlegged years ago by someone long since gone.
Could it be anything else?
Paige shrugged. It's possible it also could be erosion from the ball root of a downed tree, exacerbated by the heavy rains we had this past winter. Storms can uproot trees, and rain will erode the soil beneath it and make the ground covering grow faster. How deep and wide is the hole?
6 to 8 feet deep. 4 feet wide, roughly, Tracy said.
Paige shook her head. No, no way. More likely it's an old well.
Have you had any incidents of people falling into an old well before?
I haven't, no. But I'm aware of an incident that happened about a decade ago, before I got here. As I understand it, a young woman was riding a horse through the park when the horse came out from under her. She said it was like the horse stepped on a trap door. The fall killed the horse. It might have killed the woman, but she'd managed to jump off. There could be a report in storage. I can take a look for it tomorrow.
So the odds that somebody might have just stumbled onto this hole by chance aren't likely, Kins said.
Hard to say. That horse and rider weren't out looking for a hole. I guess, from my perspective, I'd be asking why, if someone did know of this hole, they didn't tell anyone about it, so we could have it filled in.
30. Foz pulled into his driveway exhausted, frustrated, and confused.
Larry Pinnacle could tell him until the cows came home that he just wanted to get Foz's story, but Foz knew when a detective was trying to poke holes in answers and hoping one of those holes might rip open wide enough to cast the whole story in doubt. The question was, why? What Pinnacle had conducted, awkwardly perhaps, was an interrogation, and he'd hinted that Foz's and Gonzalez's stories were not aligning. Pinnacle seemed most interested in who had yelled gun. On the drive home, Foz had gone over a potential scenario in which Gonzalez told Pinnacle that Foz had yelled gun. He concluded there were three potential reasons she might have done so. Either in the stress of the situation, Gonzalez misremembered what had happened, she was deliberately lying, or Foz had yelled gun. Foz dismissed option three based on the evidence. How could he have yelled when he had his back to the apartment door from which Lopez had emerged? He didn't see Lopez, let alone conclude that Lopez had been holding a gun. That left options one and two. Gonzalez was either misremembering what had happened, or she was lying. It would have been easy to conclude Gonzalez was lying to protect her career, but Foz knew it was not that simple. SPD detectives had recently taken a simulated course in de-escalating high-stress scenarios as part of the Justice Department's reforms to reduce the perceived use of violent force. Foz and Dell had entered the mandatory training like teenagers being forced to learn a foreign language. They saw little point to it, particularly given their already extended time on the police force. They quickly changed their tune. The class revealed that high-stress encounters with an armed suspect significantly impacted an officer's recollection, even an officer with experience. In fact, two officers working as partners could have drastically different recalls about what had happened, and often both were wrong. Seasoned officers recalled seeing guns where none existed, and mistook hands being raised in surrender for an act of aggression. Foz couldn't help but wonder if Gonzalez's memory had been similarly tainted. He looked up at his and Vera's bedroom window on the second floor. He'd called Vera after the interview, but he hadn't said anything of substance. She didn't need any more worry on her plate. He'd told her he was completing paperwork. He was about to tell Vera not to wait up, though she always did, but she'd beaten him to that punch. "I'm tired. It's been a long couple of days. I'm going to go to bed." Foz quietly entered through the back door and climbed the stairs to their bedroom. From the top step, he could see her shape beneath the covers, illuminated in a shaft of blue-gray light from the window. The four window panes created a cross on the quilt, a peaceful tableau that reminded him of a Norman Rockwell painting, a seemingly perfect portrait of life, without a hint of its often harsh realities. As Foz stepped into the room, Vera stirred. "Vic?" She turned toward the door, her voice groggy from sleep. "Yeah," he said. "Sorry to wake you." "No, it's okay. I was watching television." "What time is it?"
"It's after midnight."
"What happened?"
"I'll tell you in the morning. Everything is fine. It's all worked out."
He sat on the edge of the bed to untie his shoes. "You're okay?"
"Yeah, I'm good," he said, and thought of the hundreds of times Vera had asked him that question and how few times he'd asked her. "You doing okay?"
"I'm fine," she said. "Was it the person who put his hand on the Volkswagen?"
Foz stood and put his shoes inside his closet. "Yeah, it was."
"What happened?"
He undid his belt and slid off his slacks as he spoke. "We were knocking on the door of his last known address, and suddenly the door to an apartment behind me opened, and the guy walked out. My partner shot him."
"Dell?"
He'd not told Vera that Dell had thrown out his back. "No, Dell was home with a bad back. It was a new detective."
"Did he kill him?"
He hung the pants on a hook inside his closet door. She killed him. More brass down there than a marching band. You know how it is now. FIT got involved and I had to go into Park 95 and provide an interview."
"Are you on administrative leave?"
He climbed into bed. "Yeah, but I'm sure it will only be a couple of days. They'll make me see a shrink before I get cleared. It'll be fine."
"You sure you're all right?"
"Sure. You know how it is. It's all procedure now. Hoops I gotta jump through. I'm sure it will go to a review board and I'll get cleared. Go to sleep. Everything is going to be fine."
Foz was glad the lights were off and Vera couldn't see his face. He thought he was a good detective.
but Vera could read his expressions like a well-read book. He thought again about the evening, and if there could have been any plausible scenario that he had yelled, "Gun," if maybe he was the person misremembering what had happened. He was tired, and he'd been under a lot of stress, worried about Vera. It was possible, but no. He couldn't think of a plausible scenario.